Hi, I'm Daniel Lenzian, host of Western New York Soundstage from Buffalo Rising and Local Matters Studios. Western New York Soundstage is a podcast that looks to explore Western New York's creative economy through a series of conversations with artists, musicians, producers, directors, and authors from Western New York and beyond. On today's episode, I speak to Associate Artistic Director of the Shaw Festival, Kimberly Rampersad. The Shaw Festival is a theater festival in nearby Niagara-on-the-Lake, Ontario, Canada. It is the second largest repertory company in North America and presents a season from April to December every year. Kimberly Rampersad is a Canadian theater artist, born and raised in Winnipeg, Manitoba. As an actor, she has appeared in various theaters across Canada, including Mirvish, Stratford, and Shaw. This season, she directed both Cotton Club in the Spiegel Tent and co-directed and choreographed My Fair Lady at the Shaw Festival. Tickets are available at shawfest.com. In this episode, Kimberly and I speak about early inspirations in the theater, her work on King Lear and the Amen Corner, and her experiences with the Neil Munro Directors Project. I hope you enjoy my interview with Kimberly. Kimberly Rampersad, thank you so much for chatting with me today. How are you?
I am well. I just came in from the rain, so I am refreshed.
Well, I always like to start my interviews by asking, is there a story from your youth that connects to what you do now?
Ooh, I think there's two maybe in the mythology that my parents like to keep of my sister and myself. The first one was when I was very young, we would watch Lawrence Welk. I don't know how many of you or your listeners might be familiar with the Champagne music of Lawrence Welk, but it was something that we would watch on PBS. I think it was either on Saturday or Sunday evenings as a family. And I loved the show because it was a beautiful variety show, and it had, you know, beautiful singers and an orchestra and dancers in costumes. And in particular, one day I understand Arthur came on to tap dance, and apparently I ran up in this big, you know, old school console television, and I ran up and hugged it and started dancing with him. So I understand that my parents were just like, oh, maybe our child wants to dance and, you know, pursue this as a hobby. And then the second one is Harry Belafonte came to my city, Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. That's where I'm from. And my parents bought the four of us tickets to go see him. And apparently we were in the front row, and I was absolutely transfixed on him. And I have a very sort of neutral resting face. So I was enjoying it. I was enthralled, but my face just looked very neutral. So apparently he leaned down and he said, well, hello, young lady, are you having a good time? And I was just starstruck. But I just remember being so touched by this beautiful man who sounded similar to many of the men in my family, who was singing and dancing and storytelling and entertaining with an orchestra again, singers, dancers, full production value in a very mixed crowd, which is Winnipeg. It's a very cosmopolitan place for being in the middle of the prairies. But I was just enamored. I was just like, I think that that is magic. I think he's magical, and I would like to be a part of that. So those are probably the two moments in my life that kind of put me on this path.
What an incredible story. And it's incredible that you sort of are making magic yourself. I'd love to know, what kind of work, or where were you working before you came to the Shaw Festival?
Before I came to the Shaw Festival, I was working mostly as a freelance actor, director, and choreographer. And the season before I came to Shaw, I was at the Stratford Festival, and I was in their ensemble. And I was in that season, I was in Crazy for You and Man of La Mancha. And then the season after, that's when I came here to the Shaw Festival.
Did you start as an actor or a director or a choreographer or a dancer? Where did you kind of start your artistic practice?
My artistic practice started through dance, which led me to musical theater, which led me to theater more broadly, and also specifically. So yeah, so my background is in dance. That's my first love.
That's incredible. I'd love to know, because you are directing some incredible plays now, and I'd like to talk about them in a few minutes. But what was the moment in your life where you knew you really were a director, or you felt like, okay, I want to step into that mantle?
You know, somehow hindsight is 20/20, that I think it was always kind of living there. But I remember there were key moments when I was especially still as an actor, and I would be in the rehearsal hall And I would be fascinated with watching the director, anticipating what the director might say, finessing what I would say as a director, and watching the relationships that the director was building with everybody else in the room. And then the voice became louder and louder in my head. And I was like, oh, there's something that's gnawing at me. But it was thrilling, though. It was energizing. I didn't feel like I wanted to like push it down or quell it. I was just like, oh, I think that needs to be nurtured. And I need to see if I am just opinionated and bossy, or do I have a talent and eye disposition and the energy to devote myself to this artistic practice now? And might I be a director inside? So that happened, I think, maybe on a few contracts in a row where I felt it bubbling up, like I wanted to share or collaborate in a way that wasn't appropriate as an actor. I was like, the way to use that voice as a director. So I was like, maybe I'm a director. So then I kind of set off on that journey.
May I ask a follow-up? I'm so interested in your own practice, kind of being a choreographer and a sort of dancer and a singer coming from musical theater. When you think about a show or when you approach it, is there something that comes first for you? Is it the music or the rhythm of the language? Is it an image? Is it the movement of the piece? Is it the movement of the text? Or is it all different?
It's all different every time, but I will say that music is probably the overarching thing that I hear in all plays, the music of the play, whether it be the text, which is always, you know, wonderful because that's a word composition, but that is music, especially, you know, dealing with Shakespeare or Shaw or Baldwin. Like, I mean, these are all playwrights and orators and wordsmiths who create a soundscape. And a lot of the time when I hear the plays, I hear them in time signatures. So I did this massive play here once at Shaw, Man and Superman, and I could score it out. Like, I was like, this scene is a 3/4. This scene is a mazurka. This scene is a 2/4. This is a march. This is like a 7/8. Like, I can hear that, or in the version that lives within me. And then I kind of start structuring it from there.
That's so beautiful. I'd love to ask about your production of Lear. I saw the production. It was at the Stratford Festival, I believe, last season. And I just loved it. And I thought that the secondary characters, specifically Regan and Goneril, were treated with such dignity and respect. Was that a consideration in the process? How did, I'm just so interested in how that project came from what was on the page to what we saw in front of us.
I didn't think of it as I'm going to attack them in a different way because I feel that many other directors haven't. I attacked them that way because they were daughters and I'm a daughter. And I just said, what happens if we really attack these daughters coming from a place of goodness until power turns us, because power turns everybody in this. So I wasn't interested in trying to create them as characters that weren't already there. I wasn't there to overturn or disrupt what Shakespeare had on the page. I was like, these are all fallible characters. And I do love female characters who are fallible, because I think a lot of the time in some of this work, they're just placed on a plinth where they are idealized, where they're not allowed to be human. And I think that there's something terrific, but what if they're fighting from a place of love until they are not? And then we see how power corrupts. So I was very, very interested in that. And I was also, perhaps this is something that works in me. I have a sister and I'm incredibly close with her. And that always colors when I see sister relationships or sibling relationships on stage. So I wanted them to love each other for as long as possible until they didn't, and to love their father as long as they could until they couldn't. So that kind of really shaped how I wanted to attack it, and therefore how to activate it, and so that it felt more sustainable and dramatic, especially for the actors playing the daughters. I wanted it to feel really satisfying. So as opposed to them falling off the edge of the cliff and going to the dark side right away, what happens if they're trying, if they're grinding it out until they can no longer, and then they fall?
Did you have a similar relationship to Edgar and Edmund in that production?
I did. I did, in the same way, again, because of the sibling relationship, And I think as well too, I just find that there is more deliciousness in playing that optimism or hope until we can't anymore, because I think that's something about the human condition. And I also think that as audience members, we are very satisfied in watching characters try against insurmountable odds. And especially when it's something like Lear, when we know the end, to see the characters playing as if they don't know their own end and as if the audience doesn't know, almost like you're like, is this the same play? Because I know what's going to happen, but it doesn't feel like it's going to happen in this moment. I think that that is just the drama. And I love that.
And that is it. And that is the way that that production really felt in terms of saying, oh, gosh, I thought to myself, how are Regan and Goneril going to get to it? And it was very exciting to really watch that. So thank you for that work. I'd also like to ask about last season's Amen Corner, which was at the Shaw, specifically the staging when David walked into the audience. I sort of felt like, oh, my gosh, I had these chills. I felt like this is the metaphorical ghost of James Baldwin leaving. How did that bit of staging come about?
Wow. I appreciate you saying that, because there were a couple of people who were really touched by that gesture. I think especially what felt beautiful was the actors on the stage felt touched by it. And not that I always need to serve the actors ahead of the story or the audience. The story is the thing I must serve. But I think there are beautiful moments once in a while when you're a director where you can gift multiple audiences within the audience, not just the audience who's watching it, but the audience, the actors, and then the audience, the particular actor. The first thing was that when we had the exit happen and Andrew, who played David, when he exited off stage, I didn't get to see what his mother and his aunt felt because they were following him off. And I was like, well, that's the money. That's the empathy. That's the story. And also too, I didn't get to see his eyes and what he was walking out into. So I felt like I was ending the story, or I was sending the story off into the wings, where the stage manager who's on stage, right, would have been like, wow. But the audience needed that. And it was, and especially the monologue that David has just before he goes off, he says to his mother, I see the world differently from how you see it. And the only way I can actually believe in that is to step out into that world. What happens if we as audience members actually get to see the world the way that David sees it and see him take that brave step? What does that do to us? How does that implicate us? How might that change us? So for all of those reasons, I wanted to do that. And I also wanted to take it off the stage, because even though many people think about the Amen Corner as being sort of like a kitchen sink drama in the beautiful sense, I really felt like there was a little more magic realism, or something that goes a little more into August Wilson there, because of the music and the nature of jazz music and gospel that happens there. There's something spiritual or magical. So I felt like it could have been, it was a gesture just sort of to this intermediary place. So thanks for asking, but it was birthed out of all of those things.
Yeah, and there was something too, even though the Amen Corner can be thought of as being sort of this kitchen sink drama, what I thought was so incredible about it was the sort of scale and scope at which the Shaw Festival could produce it, to have a set that was turning and seeing sort of different aspects of people that sort of were living around that apartment building, or members of the church, or things like that. It was just such a stunning production.
Thank you. It was really great for all of us to lean into a show of that scale. And it's the first time in our history that we've had a Black playwright on the festival stage. So in order to say, what does it need in order to be sustained on that size of a stage? If we were in the studio or in the Royal George, respectfully, those require as much rigor, but different scale. If you're going to put a 3-hour drama on that stage, it needs all of that to sort of sustain it, to contextualize it, though the play on itself is the thing. But it was really nice to be able to do that, and also to kind of imagine the set the way that Baldwin speaks about it on the page. It was very nice to really be like, he talks about these two stories. Let's have these two stories. Let's have the whole world living all the time.
That was beautiful and so evident, and such an incredible Such an incredible experience. And I went back, I teach at a college, and was telling my students, like, if you have a chance, go see the Amen Corner. You know, it's such an incredibly special thing. And I gave a student a script to say, you have to learn this monologue. And I just found it to be such an incredible, it affected me. And it's one of those plays that's really stayed with me a year after it premiered. You are the associate artistic director at the Shaw Festival. What has surprised you about that position?
I think maybe how much this position touches so many other positions in the organization. Yeah, this position really reaches into, you know, the ensemble for sure of actors, but into development, into education, into programming, into all these different areas, into just, and also in maintaining relationships. Yeah, I think those are some of the large things. And then just trying as well, my number one thing is beyond that, or with that, is to make sure to be a support for TC, Tim Carroll, our artistic director, and the amount of work that he has any day is almost insurmountable, except he's superhuman, so he can do it. But in order to be able to be a support to him, I really have to work hard at that.
Thank you. Part of your position at the Shaw Festival is working with the intern directors through the Shaw's Neil Monroe Directors Project. And I honestly can't think of anyone better, because I'm learning so much about, or, you know, being reaffirmed of so much in direction just talking with you today. This season's intern directors are Tara Rosling and Peter Fernandez. Why is it important to foster new talent at the Shaw Festival?
I think it's important to do it here because of the position that we hold in Canadian theater, in terms of our influence, in terms of our age, in terms of prestige, whether it be real or perceived, the mythology of us. I think also too, in terms of the amount of bandwidth that we take up. We're the second largest repertory company in North America. And I think it behooves us to make sure that we are investing in artists, and not just for us as the Shaw Festival, but for the whole ecology of theater. And that's very important, that it can't be for us. It has to be for the upliftment, the betterment of our whole craft and of our profession. And especially when you see that, for better or otherwise, less public support or public dollars, like through governments, are happening to us. We have to really invest in us and show our value so that private donors can see the value in us, because that's the way we're going to survive, is by individual citizens seeing how theater uplifts civil, you know, civic discourse, how it enriches lives, how it just makes life more worth living, all of the other tangential things that we can draw data from, but just what theater does for life. And if you think that theater is worth it, then we have to invest in it, and we actually have to put our money where our mouths are. And then the other thing I would just say is that I did this program in 2017, and it really changed the course of how I was directing and where I was going. It's probably one of the most important things that I've ever done. And it was an incredible time. TC was one of my directors, and Ida Holmes, who was the former associate artistic director here and is now the artistic and managing director at Centaur in Montreal. She was my other director, and I had the time of my life. They whooped me so hard. Like, they worked me so hard. I worked just from dawn till dusk with them, and it was wonderful. And I want other people to have that opportunity. If they are looking for something like that, just something incredibly immersive and rigorous and life-affirming. So I want that for other people. So I'm very motivated to try and keep the standard up and the enthusiasm up.
I'd love to kind of just lean into this question a little bit and ask, was there a particular moment for you either running the program, right, or either in the program where a penny dropped and you thought, oh, wow, I hadn't seen that before. That's really shifted something for me in a completely new way.
I think watching Ida orchestrate, she was working on Dracula, and it was a huge production. And I think there was one moment when I just realized she was multitasking on such a level but was still moving slow enough for everybody to understand, clearly enough for multiple listeners to understand what she was saying, but also did not mince words, was speaking clearly, like, and not using extra pleases or thank yous. Would use a please or thank you, but just was not indulging in any sort of language to get things done. I was like, you can be kind, you can be efficient, you can be effective all at the same time. I think that was one moment where she really took my breath away. And then I think when I was in TC's room, what I really enjoyed and what I've always enjoyed about him is his rigor that he treats the actors the way my dance teachers treat dancers. The precision, the no nonsense, the take the correction, the let's get on with it. And I saw him directing with a firmness and a precision that I really understood coming from a dance background that I had rarely seen in a rehearsal hall in plays. And I was just like, that too. So those were two moments.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. And it's always a nice moment as an interviewer when someone kind of really steps back and thinks. It's a beautiful thing for me to kind of see, and I think for our listeners to hear. So thank you for your generosity answering that question. This season at the Shaw Festival, you are actually co-directing and you are choreographing My Fair Lady with TC. What has been a highlight of that collaboration?
I think one of the things is just to be in a rehearsal hall with him again. I was just talking about when I was in a rehearsal hall with him when I was his assistant director. And I think we got along like a house on fire. It's nice when we have the workloads that we have, the amount of meetings that we go to, emails, everything, conferences, all these different things, to actually find creative time in a rehearsal hall for 10 weeks. That was really good for the two of us to meet each other again as artists in a creative space. And of course, I would like to think that we try and make our boardrooms creative too, but in a real creative space, that was a highlight. A highlight was actually just the time working together again. And then I think personally, my highlight would be falling in love with the piece, My Fair Lady, even more so, even though I thought I had an understanding and a great respect for it. After working on it, that piece touches me even more deeply and sits more near and dear to my heart than I ever thought possible.
You know, I saw the production and I was shocked and so excited to be like, oh my goodness, I never realized this, but there is a Shaw play kind of underneath this musical. And it was so beautiful to hear the language and to see the scenes acted in a way I have never seen them done before. And this particular production unlocked something in my understanding of the play. And I think just again, incredible direction and storytelling by the company and UNTC.
Yeah, it really is the sum of the parts. And again, I think one of the most brilliant things about My Fair Lady is that it pulls so much, if not almost word perfect, those scenes from Pygmalion, from Shaw's Pygmalion, are dropped in. And I mean, and if we know Shaw and of his plays, Pygmalion is one of his most brilliant. It's glittering. And to be able to take that text and to put it on the stage and then to have it lived and interpreted by a quality of artists that are here is just second to none. And watching that language fly with such precision and delight, and also with beautiful tone and fully embodied and that kind of precision, like, that's just delightful. Before they even start singing, the words are singing, and that's what makes it live as a musical.
100%. In addition to that work at the Shaw Festival this year, you also have directed Cotton Club at the Spiegel Tent. What can audiences be excited about if they were to come and see that production?
Ooh, I hope you all do. I think what's great is, first, if you haven't been to the Spiegel Tent yet, we brought her in from Belgium and she's gorgeous. And she's got all of the mirrors and the stained glass, just like you would imagine. She's a beautiful circular space. So it's kind of like theater in the round, where not only do you enjoy people in the booths that you're sitting with or the table, you get to look and engage at one another. But I think the music from the era especially is very hot. We have five amazing actors, plus Paul Sportelli, our director of music, who's accompanying us. There's tap dancing, there's singing, there's torch songs. There's it just really feels grown and sexy. Dare I say, a little naughty. The only thing that we're missing is like cigarette smoke because we're not allowed to, but you can get, the bars always open during it. So you get your cocktail or get your ginger ale. We're not here to judge, but it's a real good time.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much. I also just want to say congratulations regarding the RSC, the Royal Shakespeare Company, and the Red Shoes. What are you looking most forward to about the project?
Ooh, I think I'm looking forward to the glass of wine after it opens and thinking about, wow, I didn't know it would come out like this, because I think that's the thing that I'm always thrilled and amazed by, that whatever my idea of what it might have been is never what it is at the end, because that's the joy of collaboration. So I'm sitting with these ideas right now with my designers right now, but what it will be is something that I don't even know yet. And when you sit at the end of it and you think about art truly being the sum of the parts, you just feel incredibly humbled to be like, I can't believe the good fortune of the universe to have bestowed all of these people upon me and me and their company, that we have created this thing that I could have never imagined on my own. So I'm really looking forward to the glass of wine after, maybe the glasses of wine after, for the next couple of weeks, and really beholding what it is that we've created.
Well, congratulations. That organization is extremely lucky to have you. I'd love to ask, and we sort of talked about this a little bit throughout the course of the interview, but just to ask directly, for people who are listening, both in Western New York and Buffalo, where our podcast is, but also in Canada, Niagara on the Lake, and sort of outside of that, why is an organization like the Shaw Festival so important?
Because they're the keeper of the part of our heartbeat. Our understanding of ourselves is reflected in our art. And especially as a place where we're using the English language to respond not only to the worlds that it was written in, like by the playwrights, but also to the larger Anglophone world. We're the keepers of a part of our history and culture. And not only is it a thing of the past, when we revisit it, it becomes the present. And as we interpret it, it becomes the future and the thing we want to step into. So it's an incredibly powerful thing where we're past, present, and future encapsulated. It's something beautiful that is just, because it's art, one step away from us, that allows us permission to maybe see ourselves with a little bit of a buffer, that we might be able to encounter a truth that we can't in real time. And I think that that's what theater is. I think that's what the Shaw does in particular. And I think also too, because we're a binational company, that we have both our American and Canadian sensibilities, there is a level of discourse that is both brassy and incredibly compassionate at the same time. And I think when you can straddle worlds and have thoughtful conversations and use language in a powerful way to engage, but not to try and eviscerate personally, that we are the keeper of something, unfortunately, that's aspirational, because we're not there right now in these days and times. So I think, for all of those reasons, and also beauty, and also imagination, and also feeling good, and also coming together as a community, I think those are all important things.
Thank you so much. I think maybe one of the best things about the Shaw Festival is seeing the show, but I think perhaps just as good or maybe better is the conversation on the way home.
Absolutely. That's what I love.
Mm-hmm. Kimberly, thank you so much for your time. Those are my questions, but I always like to end every interview by just asking, is there anything that you feel was left unsaid or anything you'd like to share with our listeners? Obviously, I will include all of the details about Shaw and Cotton Club and My Fair Lady in the show notes, in the introduction and outro. But if there's anything you else would like to say, and if there's not, that's cool. That's fine.
No, I thank your listeners for listening And if they haven't been to the Shaw, to come, and to come as you are. Sometimes people think that it can be very fancy pants. It is if you want it to be, but it isn't also. Just come as you are if you're interested. And I think that there's truly something for everybody. If you like music more than theater, come for the coffee concerts or the Spiegel tent. If you want something really heady, like come to see Candida. If you want something nostalgic and gorgeous, see the Secret Garden with like the Yorkshire folk tunes. If you want a mystery, you know what I mean? Come to Agatha Christie or Sherlock. Like, I just think that theater is truly for everybody. We're trying to program with everyone in mind. And we want to take care of you while you're here. So if you're interested, I hope you come. And if you've already come, thank you for coming. And please come again.
Thank you so much for your time today. It was really excellent talking to you. Thank you very much.
You too. Be well. Thanks, Daniel.
That was my interview with Kimberly Ramprasad. She was so great to talk to and so kind and generous in the interview. Cotton Club and My Fair Lady are now playing at the Shaw Festival. Tickets and more information are available at shawfest.com. This episode was produced by Jessica Marinelli. Sarah Potter engineered this episode. In addition to this podcast, you can check out our local event guides posted bi-monthly on buffalorising.com. Make sure you subscribe to the show. If you like this show, please recommend it to a friend. Thanks for listening to Western New York Soundstage from Buffalo Rising and Local Matters Studios.